Discover breakthrough technology with Masimo Rainbow Pulse CO-Oximetry. Featuring SpHb non-invasive continuous hemoglobin monitoring and PVI, a non-invasive dynamic indicator of fluid responsiveness, the Rainbow Pulse CO-Oximetry platform is designed to help support blood and fluid management initiatives without additional equipment or setup. Visit Masimo.com to learn more.
Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the June 2021 issue, selected by our journal editors. This month's podcast, we'll be exploring some new evidence related to gastric emptying time in neonates, trends in inpatient pediatric surgery, and the safety of neuromuscular blockade reversal agents. Other highlighted studies will examine the risk factors for postpartum hemorrhage and ideal mechanical ventilation approaches for obese patients. And we'll also discuss some basic science insights and new clinical reviews that will aid your practice. Let's begin this month with an observational clinical study which evaluated gastric emptying time in formula-fed neonates. This study, which used serial ultrasound to assess 46 healthy full-term neonates, found that gastric emptying was less than 2 hours with formula feeding. That time is significantly faster than the current pre-procedural fasting guidelines of 6 hours from the American Society of Anesthesiologists, and much longer than the 2.5 to 3 hour intervals at which infants are typically fed. Dr. Jennifer Lee of Columbia University conducted the study with colleagues from the University of Pittsburgh, the University of California, San Francisco, and the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary of Mount Sinai. These investigators performed ultrasound exams before and after feeding at 15-minute intervals until a return to baseline. Ultrasound images of the gastric antrum were used to estimate gastric volumes. On average, gastric emptying times were 93 minutes. They ranged from a low of 45 minutes to a high of 150 minutes. The investigators pointed out to us that the current ASA guidelines fail to account for the potential for dehydration and hypoglycemia in neonates. The investigators concluded that the current fasting guidelines for formula-fed neonates requiring anesthesia and sedation are more stringent than necessary by more than 3 hours. Read the full study for free in this month's issue. And also, refer to the editorial by Dr. Laszlo Vuckitz, which makes the case that the benefits of reducing fasting times are likely to outweigh any potential risk for healthy neonates. Our next study explores the trend of increasing consolidation of inpatient pediatric surgery services in the United States at a small number of select hospitals. Dr. Michael McManus and Dr. Urbano Franco, both of Boston Children's Hospital, conducted this two-part assessment. They found that pediatric surgical care was already highly concentrated into certain centers, even before the implementation of the American College of Surgeons Children's Surgery Verification Program. That study looked at the period immediately before the launch of that program. In Part 1, the investigators evaluated all encounter data from 6 states. In Part 2, they evaluated the generalizability of the state data against the 2016 Healthcare Cost and Utilization Project Kids Inpatient Database. The findings from the 2 data sets were strikingly similar. In the state data evaluation, the investigators found that children's hospitals, specialty hospitals, and large general hospitals with capabilities similar to children's hospitals accounted for less than 7% of all hospitals. Nevertheless, they performed 83% of all pediatric procedures. When looking at the national data set, the investigators found that less than 9% of hospitals that admit children accounted for 90% of all pediatric procedures. These authors concluded that pediatric surgical care was already highly concentrated before the rollout of the Children's Surgery Verification Program. They note that the consolidation of pediatric surgical care has a number of important implications, and these range from workforce distribution to general access to care. This article is available for free in this month's issue. And read the accompanying editorial for more information about what these trends mean for pediatric training in anesthesia residencies, the educational preparation of pediatric anesthesia subspecialists, and the implications for pediatric anesthesia fellowships. Next, we have a retrospective registry analysis which evaluated the rate of postoperative pulmonary complications associated with the use of different drugs for reversing neuromuscular blockade. The study was conducted by Dr. Jen Lee and colleagues at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. These investigators evaluated the data from 7,800 surgical patients who had received neostigmine and nearly 2,700 patients receiving the newer drug, Sigamidex. This comparison reflected a wholesale switch from neostigmine to Sugammadex at this single academic tertiary care center. The investigators looked specifically at a composite of pulmonary complications that included pneumonia, prolonged mechanical ventilation, and unplanned intubation, all within 30 days of surgery. Overall, the rate of post-op complications in all patients was 5.5%, with a slightly higher rate for neostigmine, 5.9%, and a slightly lower rate for Sigamidex, 4.2%. After making the appropriate adjustments in the analysis of the data, there was no statistically significant difference in the occurrence of postoperative pulmonary complications between the two neuromuscular blockade reversing drugs. The authors concluded that switching neuromuscular blockade reversal agents was not associated with any difference in the occurrence of postoperative pulmonary complications. This article is available for free in this month's issue. And be sure to check out the related editorial, which highlights the conflicting data regarding the association between neuromuscular antagonist use and pulmonary outcomes. And the editorial also explores the landscape of current evidence and the costs associated with neuromuscular blocking drug reversal agents and postoperative pulmonary complications. Our next study sheds some light on a possible new risk factor for postpartum hemorrhage. Researchers led by Dr. Alexander Buttwick at Stanford University School of Medicine and colleagues in the United States and Sweden found a significant association between post-term birth and the risk for postpartum hemorrhage. The researchers examined live delivery data for more than 2 million deliveries in California and about 300,000 deliveries in Sweden. The investigators saw significant differences in the rate of postpartum hemorrhage in the two cohorts, with a rate of 3.2% in California and 7.1% in Sweden. They also found an increased risk for hemorrhage in both cohorts for deliveries that occurred between 41 and 42 weeks when compared to term deliveries. There was also an elevated risk seen between 22 and 27 weeks, but only for deliveries in the California cohort. The study authors advise clinicians to be aware of this new evidence when assessing the risk for hemorrhage and suggested that this evaluation should inform clinical guidelines. The article's available for free in this month's issue. And a related editorial notes that enhanced assessment of postpartum hemorrhage risk is a national priority for maternal safety. It also explores what is known about postpartum hemorrhage risk and suggests that the time may be right to consider postterm gestational age as a risk factor, especially if other large studies and follow-up continue to show a strong association. Next, we have a secondary analysis showing the superiority of individualized positive end expiratory pressure, or PEEP, over fixed PEEP levels for intraoperative mechanical ventilation of obese patients. The study was conducted by Dr. Philip Simon and the PROBEES investigators of the Protective Ventilation Network and the Clinical Trial Network of the European Society of Anesthesiology. This study pools data on obese patients from two previously published studies, the multicenter PROBEES trial and a local single-center trial at the University of Leipzig Medical Center in Germany. All the patients who evaluated had undergone elective laparoscopic abdominal surgery and had a total body mass index of at least 35. They were randomized to receive either low PEEP, 4 to 5 centimeters of water, or to a recruitment maneuver, followed by either a PEEP of 12 centimeters of water, or individualized PEEP, which was determined by electrical impedance tomography. The analysis found that median individualized PEEP levels were 18 centimeters of water and resulted in better intraoperative oxygenation, lower driving pressures, and redistribution of ventilation compared with fixed PEEP at both high or low levels. But the study also found that the benefits disappeared after extubation. Individualized PEEP also resulted in improvements in lung function, but the analysis was not really powered to show improvements in clinical outcomes. The authors concluded that while the intraoperative outcomes were better with individualized PEEP, the impact on patient outcome was unclear. This article is available for free in this month's issue. And read a related editorial, which takes us down the long road of understanding PEEP selection and explores some of the key unanswered questions. It suggests that very high PEEP levels, greater than 10 to 12 centimeters of water, should not be routinely implemented in clinical practice, at least before we obtain more definitive evidence that this ventilation approach is associated with improved pulmonary outcomes. Our next article reports a basic science research study looking at mitochondrial function and anesthetic sensitivity in the spinal cord of mice who have a mutation in the protein NDUF4. This mutation makes them hypersensitive to anesthesia. The experiment revealed a link between anesthetic sensitivity, mitochondrial function, and postsynaptic channel activity that could have downstream clinical implications related to the minimum alveolar concentration, or MAC. The study was conducted by Christian Woods at Seattle Children's Research Institute and colleagues at the University of Washington. The investigators tested the hypothesis that volatile anesthetics would disrupt the presynaptic function or other neuronal characteristic in the spinal cord neurons of mice with a mutation that knocked out the protein NDUFS4. While their initial hypothesis was incorrect, what they found instead was fascinating. Presynaptic functions in the mutated mouse spinal cords were not hypersensitive to isoflurane. Instead, the hypersensitivity in the mutated mice was mediated by interneurons in the ventral horn. The manuscript concludes that the data link anesthetic sensitivity, mitochondrial function, and postsynaptic channel activity. And read the related editorial, which explores the issue of MAC and the new questions that are raised by this basic research. The editorial reminds us that anesthetics are dirty drugs, meaning that they have multiple effects in numerous organs and systems. And it reminds us that different mechanisms underlie anesthesia in these different systems, like the brain, spine, and autonomic nervous system. And lastly, it reminds us that because of these differences, there can be no universal depth of anesthesia monitor. Next is our clinical focus review article that examines perioperative management of patients for whom transfusion is not an option. Dr. Nicole Gwynn of Duke University Medical Center and colleagues at Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions authored this report. They emphasize the need for careful planning, documentation, and the involvement of a multidisciplinary care team to achieve blood conservation at the preoperative, intraoperative, and postoperative phases of care. These techniques range from early diagnosis and treatment of anemia to the use of topical sealants and hemostatic agents to minimizing laboratory testing. Since Jehovah's Witness patients make up a significant portion of patients who cannot be transfused, it's critical to determine what other therapies are acceptable. Some Jehovah's Witness patients may accept minor fractions, such as cryoprecipitate, albumin, immunoglobulins, and individual clotting factors. For more details, suggested protocols, and clinical guidance, see the full article in the journal. And I'll close this month with a review article that describes the various scoring systems for quantitative lung ultrasound and how these can be used in different clinical settings. The review was authored by Dr. Silvia Mongatti of San Mateo Hospital in Pavia, Italy, and colleagues from centers across Europe. The article breaks down the use of scoring systems for acutely ill patients, critically ill patients, and patients in the perioperative setting, as well as pediatric and neonatal patients, and the use of ultrasound as a tool in chronic disease management. The review even tackles how lung ultrasound can be used to accurately predict the severity of disease in COVID-19 patients. Read the full article for details and information on how computer-aided technology could make assessments even faster. Thank you for your interest in and support of anesthesiology and our podcast. I hope the information provided helps you to guide and improve your clinical practice. And I look forward to sharing more important research with you next month.
Breakthrough technology, breakthrough outcomes. A key study conducted at CHU Limoges Hospital in France demonstrated the value of implementing a hospital-wide goal-directed therapy protocol for blood and fluid management using the Masimo Rainbow Pulse CO-oximetry platform, showing a 33% reduction in 30-day post-surgical mortality. Visit Masimo.com to learn more.